Radio.
Most climbers I see nowadays, compared to 10 years ago, spend way too much time doing general, non-specific strength and conditioning works, which doesn't actually relate to climbing.
Hey y'all, I'm Ryan Devlin, and welcome to this month's Struggle Climbing Show Coach Chat with the one and only Tom Randall. Our good buddy from across the pond is back for our first ever live call-in episode. Oh man, I'm super excited about this one, you guys. I put out a little announcement on Patreon and Instagram a little while ago, and I got a ton of submissions from you all. And today we have five climbers who are representing a wide range of skills and abilities. I'm talking 20-year-olds to 40-year-olds, men, women, non-binary, boulderers, sport climbers, traddies, 5 foot nothing to 6 foot seven. I guarantee you there is a climber in this conversation here today that you're going to be able to relate to. And you will absolutely take away some actionable beta as Tom coaches everybody here today through their issues. And those issues range from how to train to recover better on sport routes. I'm talking about how to actually train resting, to dealing with mental blocks around thinking you can't achieve the next hardest grade, to a boulderer trying to train up his endurance for sport climbing, and on the other side, a boulderer slash trad climber trying to figure out when to weight train and when to focus on peak during the season that she's in, to a very tall climber in a small box world, and so much more. Get ready for some awesome beta today. This episode is sponsored by Crimped. Crimped offers 75 different workouts created by world-class coaches and climbers totally for free, you guys. I've been using Crimped for years to log my finger strength and endurance assessments so that I can see how effective my training has been going. And I also love how easy and motivating it is to program my weekly training right there in the app with loads of proven workouts to choose from so that I can just keep things fresh. Look, if you're a self-coached climber, I am telling you, the absolute best and easiest way that I've ever found to train and stay on track is with Crimped. They group their workouts, y'all, into categories. So endurance, power endurance, strength and conditioning, boom, no confusion. I'm telling you, I use it all the time, and I am definitely far more consistent with my training when I've got the app keeping me honest and on track, and it just feels so good at the end of the week to close out those bars. You can hit that link in your notes or go to thestruggleclimbingshow.com/crimped, C-R-I-M-P-D, to download it for free and take your training to new heights. This episode's brought to you by Arc'teryx and their incredibly cool Climb Academy, which is back now for its 17th year this summer out in Squamish, British Columbia. Y'all, I have chatted with Arc'teryx athletes here on this show. You know them, Jonathan Segrist, Amity Warm, and Jordan Cannon. And it sounds like this event is one of the coolest things you can attend in all of climbing. I am hoping to get out there myself for it. I would love to see you there, but we are going to have to move fast because, no doubt, this thing's going to sell out quickly like it always does. So what is this Climb Academy experience? Well, it's an epic 3-day event geared towards all skill levels, and it includes clinics taught by top athletes, boom, worth the price of admission right there, film premieres, live music, and you just get to go play all day on some of the most pristine granite the world has to offer. The Climb Academy runs from August 23rd to the 25th out in beautiful Squamish, BC. Cannot think of a cooler place to go. To view the entire clinic lineup and grab a spot, you can swing over to thestruggleclimbingshow.com/climbacademy or just hit that link right there in your notes. The clinics go on sale May 9th. All right, let's jump into our first ever live call-in coaching session with the one and only Tom Randall. First of all, I got to give you credit, Tom, because I think in one of our prior coach chats, you're like, hey, we should try to do a call-in where, you know, it's I think you were probably just getting tired of talking with me about my own climbing issues.
No.
And some other people to call in. And here we are. We've got some climbers on the show.
Yeah. Here they are, smiling faces, all looking. I feel like everyone's looking somewhat apprehensive, actually, which is good because I felt like I was going to be the apprehensive one, not knowing what we're going to be talking about today.
Well, I told them all that you were kind of a monster to work with, and so they're a little unsure. I want to catch up with you, Tom, and then we'll open it up to our climbers. We'll do a round of introductions. There's a couple things I just wanted to get a quick little update from you on. One, was this trip to Thailand that you took with Anna Hazelnut. That was the last time you and I connected. You were just about to depart for that trip. A video just dropped that Anna put out that you guys created as you were doing some route development there. And I think more to come, a documentary and all sorts of good stuff. And it just from the video I've seen already, it looks like you guys were getting into all sorts of trouble. So what was the takeaway from that experience?
What was the main takeaway? I think it was, so one is the amount of undeveloped, untapped rock in Thailand is just phenomenal. I'd always have thought that it was a coastline thing. And yeah, you go to the beaches and you go to, you know, Krabi, et cetera, and Rylai and where everyone thinks of as being Thai sport climbing. But you go inland and there's exactly the same stuff. A little bit different in style, but very, very underdeveloped. But a big part of it is around the bureaucracy and the access to rock. So they have a lot of problems as a nation, essentially officially endorsing rock climbing and people being able to bolt routes and access it and things like that without the areas being closed down. So I think that was one really interesting thing about the country and the climbing. And then the other was just around the growth and openness to climbing as being an activity and something to do, despite a lot of the areas that we were in being really very rural areas. But people grasped the climbing, and we had some school groups come out and come and have their first go at climbing and get on ropes and have a go at some sport routes and everything. And it was just really awesome doing something, giving a bit of access to other people that wouldn't normally get it, but them appreciating that climbing, what it involves, and wanting to have a go. So it was really nice.
That's really cool. It's so interesting to think that like the next greatest rock climber, the next greatest, you know, groundbreaker in this sport that we all love so much might be out there and it just hasn't been introduced to climbing yet.
Yeah. I mean, I met one kid out there who is called Ozzy, and his climbing is just phenomenal. That kid's going to be world-class in not that long amount of time. I've not seen ability like that in a long time. And climbing V12s in almost just a handful of goes in boiling hot heat with humidity. And yeah.
Get out of here. Oh my gosh.
And making them look so easy as well.
Ozzy, come on the show. Let's dive into it. Our first ever call-in episode, maybe our last ever. We'll see how it goes. This is a wild experiment here. But we've got climbers that represent all sorts of good stuff. So Derek, I'm going to let you introduce yourself to Tom, maybe, you know, age, climbing style, and, you know, what kind of climber you are right now, knowing that we all can be different climbers at different times, but what you're psyched on right now, and then present to him whatever it is that you're working on. And this is your own little mini coaching session with Tom Randall here.
Very cool. Thanks. Derek Childers, 33 years old, here in Louisville, Kentucky. I would say my climbing style is a very static enduro climber, which kind of goes really well with me being in Louisville, because obviously I climb a lot in the Red River Gorge. And so that will lead, I guess, directly into my current project, which is where my question is kind of based on. My question is based on recovery. And so my project is a route called Death by Chocolate, and it is a 120-foot just enduro route with all active rest. And I've had a really hard time after I get through the crux, which is about halfway up. This crux is probably about 2 V grades below my max. And so when I pull that crux, I do 2 more bolts of climbing, and I'm actually on a pretty good hold, but I cannot recover. And there's still 4 more bolts of climbing. And so I just cannot recover. And so, you know, I'm only able to get out once a week. And so I was really hoping you could help me understand maybe a better way for me to train recovery, but in a gym setting.
Okay. Yeah. Well, first of all, nice to meet you, and welcome to being the first guest on here. Let's see how this goes. Yeah. So it's a really good question around the recovery element. And I think a very popular one that people will ask, because when it comes to climbing on sport routes or trad routes for that matter, the recovery element is not a very simple one, because recovery on a hold can look so different, all the way from when you've gone to full red line and then you're trying to recover on actually quite a good hold to getting mildly tired, but then trying to recover on quite a mediocre hold. So it's quite a complex thing. And the reason why it's quite complex is you've got both the factor of the overall level of fatigue that you've accumulated during your climb. So that's one thing that builds into this and how recovery is. And then the second is the intensity or the difficulty of the hold that you're trying to recover on in relation to your maximum strength. So with that, with regards to that, when you give me the dilemma that you have right now in terms of this recovery on what is quite a mediocre hold on your route, and it's something where you're just kind of going all out on the route and it's quite continuous and quite sustained, is the real area for opportunity in terms of training and improving and making that hold feel better for recovery is actually to increase the maximal level of strength that you have on that hold, plus the ability to develop skill associated with that hold as well. So the reason why I split this down as both strength and skill is that strength in everything, every sport, is both a sort of a physiological, anatomical thing, but it's also a skill thing. So you can get stronger by being more skillful. So to deal with that aspect in particular, when I would approach this in the gym and you've got your hold and the shape of the hold, the position, the angle of the wall and everything like that, is I would be going to the gym and replicating and mimicking the exact hold size, even potentially texture and angle of the hold and the terrain that you're going to be resting on, all the way from how you maybe use a heel toe cam, how you sit your hips into the wall, how you twist in, how you hold your shoulders, because this aspect will really make it feel like your recovery is better. Because if you can become more skillful at your rest, it actually drops the relative intensity down. And the problem with this is if you don't get the intensity low enough, you'll always stay more in this kind of like high intensity anaerobic zone, which means that recovery just isn't going to happen. You're just going to get more and more fatigued and you're going to have more a sort of occlusion of that blood flow. You're going to have less chance of recovery. So that's one really important aspect. And what I would do, like I've done a lot of that over the years of my own replica training, is just build. People do it with knee bars loads and you can do it with cracks, and you can like quite often in quite a stressful position in a roof, for example, and trying to find out how to actually relax in that. And that's very, very effective.
So Tom, just so I'm clear here, you're talking about building a replica of the rest, not of the crux.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And yeah, practicing the rest.
Exactly. Yeah.
So climbing until pumped or whatever you would perceive to be kind of a level of pump that you would have going into that, and then just trying to recover on the replicated rest.
So that would be more looking at the physical aspect of the resting. Here, I'm just talking about the skill. So just spend time in the rest. You want to become an expert at your rest. I don't know if anyone here has noticed this, but when you first project a route that has something that's quite technical in a rest, maybe like a marginal knee bar, the first session you have on, you go, oh, this is desperate. I can probably rest on this knee bar for 30 seconds and I can maybe take one hand off at a time. Then 10 sessions later, you're no handing on it and you are on there for 5 minutes. You're not much stronger, honestly. You're just more skillful at it. So there's this same aspect in terms of the rest that you're trying to find. And then the other part of it would be the strength element of that rest. So the way that I would look at that is I would be training your maximum strength level on the grip type and size that you're using your rest on. So pay attention to whether it's, you know, sloper, half crimp, full pad, two pads, etc. So the stronger that you get on a rest, then the more it fits into that sort of low intensity bracket. So it'll feel relatively better. It's just like if we take a 515 A sport climber versus a 510 sport climber, if you give them the same hold to rest on, one will say it's not a rest, neither one will, because they're stronger. So increasing the base level of strength on your fingers. And then I would also look at exactly the same in terms of your shoulders and core in that same position, because there will be a strength element to that as well. And the more that you can kind of raise the ceiling, then that will feel relatively more relaxed. So I've done this a little bit in the past with weight vests and things like that, and just kind of stressing the shoulders and stressing the core a little bit more. So you get really accustomed to working at a higher intensity from a training aspect. And then when you try the route, you go, wow, this feels night and day.
No, that's perfect. The rest is very like extended for me. Like all the good feet are, I'm like super extended, right? And so all that really makes a lot of sense because, you know, it is a lot of core, a lot of calf, a lot of shoulders. So that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, that's the approach that I would take. And I've seen others do really well with that. And it's almost like a practice that I would love to see more climbers doing in general, that when you see them in the gym and they're kind of going around their circuit boards or they're doing their problems on a system board, is I'd like to see them more just getting off the circuit and then going into the corner and going and finding like a weird, awkward rest position and learning it and becoming more skillful at it. A friend of mine who's very good at knee barring in the UK, like well known for being extremely good at it. I was watching him do a session the other day down at the lockup here at Lattice, and he was down here with two knee bar pads on, just going around the circuit board, finding rests all over the place. And he practices it all the time.
That's awesome.
Really great advice. I love that. I love, you know, we just put so much emphasis on practicing, you know, replicating crux moves and top end strength, which of course is important in its own right. But then to really be practicing the skill of the rest is very cool, Tom. Thank you. Derek, any final kind of questions there? We'll be able to loop back, but I want to make sure we pass over to some of these other climbers as well.
Yeah, no, I'm good, Ryan. Thanks so much. Thanks, Tom.
I know where it's still.
Right on. Okay, good. Well, that'll bring us over to Johnny, more in your neck of the woods than ours. Johnny, go ahead and introduce yourself, where you at, maybe your age, and if you're willing to share, and what you have for Tom.
Yeah, hello. Hello, Tom. It's Johnny. I'm based in Luxembourg, and I'm 42 years old. I climb 24 years now already, on and off relationship with climbing, always passionate, but not always strong, not always trained. And yeah, that's kind of what my question is also about, because I have the feeling that over the time I developed a state of mind that I cannot go on hard for me climbs. That's just a no-go. It feels kind of like an imposter syndrome. You cannot go on these climbs. So how does other people view you? The self-doubt comes in. And I have, for example, a thing that happened to me in the climbing checklist the other day. I was on the Kilter board and a strong Luxembourgish climber approaches me and just ask if you can join me and we train together. Well, of course, I said, you, of course, do it. I was projecting some Kilter 7As there. And he was a really strong guy. And then we started a chat about the climbing areas around and if I know this and that. And then he said, do you know this this 8A route that's called Desert Lumière? I said, yeah, you should go on it. I said, wait a minute. you saw me climbing. I asked him, you saw me climbing. I'm not an 8A climber at all. Yeah, but it's a really cool route. You should just give it a try. And at that moment, I knew I really have a problem on going on hard stuff. I would never, ever imagine going on an 8A route. Never. I'm projecting 7A, 7Bs, 5AB, something like that. And I would never, ever imagine going on something hard like that. So that's my question. How can I deal maybe psychologically with that to just try some harder stuff? I guess I maybe can climb harder. I don't know. But yeah, always when I approach a climb like this, now you're wrong here. You belong to the other crack.
Yeah, well, nice to meet you, Johnny. I think it's a really pertinent question because climbing is constantly based on this concept of pushing yourself outside of your comfort zone. You know, the nature of climbing is that culturally we call projecting an extended process which involves lots of failure, where we don't often achieve what we set out to do for potentially 5 sessions, 10 sessions, longer sometimes. Or it could be on the micro scale where you have 2 or 3 goes at the crag on the day and then you do it on your 4th go. So this sort of failure or deferred success, which is kind of part of our normal ebb and flow of climbing. So I think what I would say to you is, one is to try and complete some kind of exercise And I often find this stuff's good in a kind of a journal or done with friends around a beer or a coffee, people that you know really quite well. And think about what is it that you actually value the most about trying things which are a little bit hard and a little bit challenging for you. So really key in with your friends or yourself, what is it that you value from that process in the first place? So find yourself in a position of sort of like, I guess, optimism and opportunity around that particular topic. Because I think it's important to have something that you at least can hold on in a positive sense with this, because you're going to have to deal with some things which are going to be tougher further down the line when you do take on a harder project and go way outside your comfort zone. So that'd be step one. And then the next thing I would do with this is I would be looking at hard projecting and going, what is it that when I think about going and climbing that 8A that someone's just suggested me to the gym is causing me concern, stress, anxiety, whatever it is? Like, what is the element within that which gets to me? Is it that I'm going to go to the crag and people are going to watch me and they're going to make some sort of judgment on me because I failed? Is it going to be that I don't identify as an 8A climber? Is it going to be that I have never gone that far outside of my comfort zone? So it's actually a really odd thing for me to do. I'm like not super comfortable with being outside of my comfort zone. So I think it's about sort of like a self-profiling exercise where you understand what are all these things which you have hard to tackle in this situation. So I would list all of those down. And then as a result, I would try and create scenarios where you can go and try an 8A or something which is hard for you, where you can eliminate some of those key factors for you. So to give you an example, for me, I might find that as a professional climber, I'm really used to and I'm really aware that people just watch me all the time wherever I go climbing. And I can get really self-conscious if I'm going and doing something which I know I'm really likely to fail on. It's not my style. I'm probably just going to look rubbish. So if I want to get into a situation where I can have a good experience from pushing myself out of my comfort zone, I might actually very deliberately choose a crag, which is really quiet, where lots of people aren't, and I'm going to go with someone who's a very supportive partner. And then I'm more likely to have a good experience in that. And then what I'll try and do is stack up those experiences in multiples. Because with anything in life, you're trying to tackle something which is uncomfortable for you. You can't just solve it with one experience. I think it's actually about building up a repertoire and a routine of doing this thing repeatedly where you get a semi-good experience out of it. It can be somewhat uncomfortable, but it's got to feel decent to you. It's not going to feel like, oh my goodness, I hated that. I was so full on. I didn't enjoy it. And then you'll find after 5 times, 10 times, you've got a bit of self-confidence and your mind and body are kind of aware of what that feels like, what that looks like to do it. And you might find yourself after 5 or 10 days of going and doing that at a different crag, you go, you know what? I am going to go and have a go on that 8A in the gym where a load of people might be watching because I've done this like 10 times at another place and it was okay. I didn't have that bad an experience. So I think it's about finding, yeah, your own personal sort of limitations or things that you find hard for you, reducing them in a controlled environment, and then getting to a practiced zone where it's enough, but not too much. And that's the approach that I would tend to take with this kind of thing.
Okay. Thank you very much. So to understand it right, I train to be uncomfortable.
Yeah, you've got to expose yourself to it a little bit, but it's about doing it in a way which is somewhat controlled by you and you're not putting yourself into that full-on over-the-top zone. It's a bit like when you tell people about taking some fall practice, for example. You never say, oh, start off with taking some big 50-foot whips. You say, try and just sag onto the bolt with like a one-foot fall or a 1 meter fall, and you know, you build up slowly. And I think it's exactly the same psychologically. I've done it loads over the years. I don't just dive in and go crazy. I build up slowly.
Yeah, as you said, I should consider what it is that keeps me maybe back. Or I had one thing in my mind directly. It was my body image that I have of myself. So sometimes I feel I just don't look like a climber. I would not consider me as overweight or something, but I'm just not built like the usual 8A climber, however you might call that. And that was the first thing that came to my mind as you said that. So I struggle actually kind of a lot with that, so that I sometimes really don't feel like a climber just visually. Any tips on that?
Yeah. I mean, I've definitely heard this a lot. I suppose I'm in some ways in a similar phase in my life that I feel like, oh, well, I can't be a pro climber anymore because I'm not 25 years old and I'm kind of like on the older end of pro climbers out there. And so I have that same kind of identity thing around like, do I actually look like the rest of them? And I feel like the way to approach this stuff is to, again, think about your environment that you're operating in and go, what are the things that will make this feel not such an issue for me? And what are the people and the behaviors that will make this item not as difficult for me? So that, again, goes back to things like finding climbing partners who are really supportive of you or are even do look exactly like you, or going into an environment where you feel like it's just not as stressful on this particular aspect that you're working with. So it might be going to the gym indoors, or it might be going trad climbing rather than sport climbing. You know, it's just changing your environment a little bit to control it and just dim the lights a little bit, just turn the dial down a bit on it. And with repeated exposure in a positive way, I think you can tackle quite a lot of this stuff. It's just not quick. That's the reality. It takes time.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you, Tom. And Johnny, thank you as well, you know, for opening up on an aspect of climbing where we tend to be more focused on measurable results of finger strength and these kinds of things. But in conversations that I've had with Hazel and like Tom just reinforced there, there's so much to be unlocked on the mental and emotional side of climbing that will not only help us to level up our climbing, but also enjoy it more and likely will have a positive effect on our lives as well. So thank you for bringing that. Really appreciate it. Stay on the line here because we'll probably loop back on some of this stuff, but I want to shift over to Katie and check in with you, Katie. Where are you at? What kind of climbing are you into right now? And feel free to just dive right in with Tom.
Yeah, thanks for having me. So yeah, my name is Katie Mayo. I am originally from Virginia, but I'm currently based out of Bishop, California. I'm living in my Honda CR-V and I just joined a gym. So I typically like techie vert climbing and I've been doing a lot of bouldering this season, but it's starting to get pretty hot here and the snow is melting out. So I'm getting ready to do some taller stuff this summer. And I would say that strength is generally my weakness. So I've been trying to like use the gym and like get stronger and squat and get ready for long approaches and stuff like that. But I'm kind of still trying to perform in both categories, I guess. I'm trying to finish up some projects bouldering, and I'm finding that lifting is kind of getting in the way of performing for climbing. Like it's sapping me both physically and mentally, and also like my skin. And so I'm wondering, can I do both? And if so, how?
And just to check that I've understood this correctly, when you say by lifting, we're talking about lifting big heavy weights, so squats, deadlifts, Olympic lifting, etc.
Yeah, I'm squatting and deadlifting.
Yeah, okay. There's a few different answers or different avenues that we could go down with this. I think as a guiding principle initially to kind of give you on this particular topic is that if you're in a position where you're wondering how you can do both of them, but push yourself hard and improve on both of them or perform in both of them, then normally the answer is you shouldn't be doing both of them. Because if it was right for you and it was working really well, you probably wouldn't be asking the question in the first place. And it's more around this dilemma of like, how do I prioritize? Because it sounds like you have an appreciation that both of them have a benefit to you and they're both things that you want to do and you hopefully enjoy doing both of them. But it's really about staggering and organizing, strategizing them so that they occur at the right part of the year or in the right order so that it benefits your performance in the long term. So what we'll do a lot of the time with athletes at Lattice in terms of approaching this off-the-wall gym training plus performance on rock is that we tend to divide the year up into blocks of training which are more heavily focused on off-the-wall training, larger muscle groups, things to do with like core, legs, shoulders, back, etc., in the off-season when you're not performing on rock, mainly because when you get further down the performance curve and you're getting closer to your potential that you have as an athlete, is that you have to focus really good quality into your training. And you can't just do this mid-ground of, oh, I'm turning up and I'm doing the training, I'm doing the hard work, I feel tired. Because in that situation, you end up just getting substandard results and you just grind forward slowly. Sometimes pick up a few more injuries in that way as well. So what I would encourage you to do is to think about, if I want to have my projects outside, what's the best season for this? And really focus on improving that and doing some amount of small complementary maintenance work in the lifting S&C, you know, strength and conditioning work alongside it. But it's only in maintenance to then set you up into subsequent base periods where the season's not so good for the outdoor rock, or you're done with your project and you can, because I know some parts of the world you have, you know, perfect conditions all the year long, not like us Brits. And when you come off that, you go into the base training and focus on that a little bit more and you're spending less time on rock. But it does come with the caveat that most climbers I see nowadays compared to 10 years ago spend way too much time doing sort of general non-specific strength and conditioning works which doesn't actually relate to climbing and isn't a limiting factor. Like it does worry me when I see people in the gym just doing loads of deadlifting and squatting and shoulder press work and Olympic lifting. It's just too much, in all honesty. It'll make you feel great and you'll see really good improvements in those exercises, but it won't transfer in the long term half as well into climbing than it would by taking a more specific approach to climbing. So it can be a little bit of a mistake to get too derailed or distracted by that stuff.
Got it. Sounds good.
I'm curious, Tom, just on that point there about kind of the off the wall versus on the wall or on rock training and movement, as you're working with clients who are really psyched about doing the shoulder presses and the deadlifts and the core and feeling strong and this kind of thing. Is there a hard and fast rule on kind of a percentage that you want them moving on rock or, you know, on routes, on plastic versus that, you know, kind of more generalized strength and conditioning?
What number would I put on it? For most climbers, you shouldn't be spending much more than 20% of your time off the wall on S&C work away from climbing, bearing in mind that you could alter that ratio if you were in, you know, heavy base season and you couldn't get very much access to rock, or last season you'd picked up some really big problems with your shoulders and you were doing loads of gym conditioning work because ultimately you lack muscle mass in the shoulders and you keep having recurring issues, then you could argue, well, you could spend, you know, 30, 40% of your time in the gym doing that. But you just definitely wouldn't do it all year long. But if I look at climbers out there and I see these specimens in the gym that are really good with, you know, their calisthenics work, their gym work, their weights work, and I watch how they move, I watch how well conditioned they are, and then I watch them climb and I go, oh, you are nowhere near climbing what I expect you would be. It's because they're generally spending too much time in the gym and the time on rock is really limited. It's a skill sport. You, as strong as you want to be, you have to be skillful with it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you for that perspective. One other kind of question comes to mind, because Katie mentioned that, you know, she's living out of her car right now. She's in Bishop, but it sounds like, Katie, you can chase the conditions. You can chase the psych where it's going. And so for athletes like Katie, and also some pro climbers who have the luxury of being able to take trips and follow fantastic conditions, there's the potential for there not actually being an off season or a down season. You could almost always be in performance season. And then how do you look at bringing in these periods of conditioning where you aren't trying to send, even though you literally could be trying to send at any moment in time.
Yes. Yeah, so the compartmentalization or the blocking of time when you're in peak performance versus base climbing or base training, I think has to be a flexible item according to the amount of motivation you have, the amount of burnout that you have, partners available to you, how close you are on a project. And I don't think there can be hard and fast rules other than I would be very worried if someone was spending year after year 75% or more of their time in base mode or 75% or more in time in peak mode. Like either of those two things, it's like three quarters of over. If you're doing that year after year after year, you're just going to stack up your chances of issues occurring. And those issues could be anything from long-term burnout. It could be from picking up more injuries than you did before. It could be just stagnating at the grade and just not going forward. There's a whole number of issues that you could put into those categories, but a nice balance between the two, I think, is really good. And if you look at most pro climbers who are at the cutting edge of the game nowadays compared to where they were before, you will see them very definitely wax and wane between these cycles of peak performance and times when they come off. And they change up what they do quite a lot. The pro climber who just spends all their time projecting outside and only climbing on rock outside and being the vast majority of the best people at the limit, I think is kind of over. I think now you're seeing more the new school modern climber who's come from the gym experience, done quite a lot of weights conditioning work, is more of a sort of indoor international competition climber gone outdoor climbing. And those people really will become the dominating force in climbing at the top end.
Cool perspective, Tom. Thank you. Yeah, I think we're already starting to see some of that trend. And even a couple comp climbing Brits who came over and hopped on El Cap as their first go at Bidwalls and did the thing. So yeah, a lot of that can translate.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there's a lot that we've learned from indoor climbing and all of the higher level training that's gone with it over the years and how that's then transferred back out into rock. And I think it's great seeing that it can do both things. And I love seeing people get to enjoy the outdoors 10 years later after having spent most of their teenage years inside in a gym climbing on plastics and then suddenly going, oh my God, there's this outside world of real rock and absolutely crushing it at the same time. It's really cool.
Yeah, such a great experience. Katie, thank you so much for your question. Did Tom address everything that you wanted? Any final follow-ups based on what he said there?
No, that was really helpful. I think it might be time to press pause on some of the bouldering goals now that it's getting hot and just wait for the fall. Focus on trad climbing and training. Thank you.
This episode is supported by Boulder Bears, caffeinated gummy bears. Oh my gosh, I've already got a smile on my face just saying it. I love these things so much. They taste like candy and they kick like coffee. They are legit fantastic. I'm pretty sensitive to caffeine personally. If I take too much, it makes me jittery, kind of gets in my head. That is not what I want when I'm on a route. And so what's cool about these Boulder Bears is that each one contains 20 milligrams of caffeine plus a little bit of collagen so that I can perfectly dial in the boost that I want and also take care of my tendons while I'm at it. So like if I'm going to have a long day at the crag, maybe I'll have one an hour and it'll just keep me like focused up with a little bit of energy that'll last all day. Or if I'm going to go hit like a moonboard session or a bouldering session really hard, I'll have like four or five gummies all at once and boom. It gives me that hit, that boost, that focus right when I need it. I also love that they're just tiny and they're light, so they don't weigh down my pack on the hike in or my stomach when I'm trying to climb at my limit. There's no like liquid, like, you know, coffee or Red Bull sloshing around when I'm trying to pull hard. I love these Boulder Bears so much. You can score a free refillable travel pouch plus 15% off when you order a bundle right now using code STRUGGLE over at boulderbears.com. They're a small company. I know the owner. It's such a cool thing they're doing. The link is right there in your podcast player. Boulder Bears, all flash, no crash. This episode is supported by Rungne, which of course is Magnus Mitbo's brand that you all know about. They make rad clothing and high performance chalk all at great prices. And I gotta say, you guys, after using Magdust chalk and climbing in Rungne pants for a long while now, The quality is off the charts. Their pants and their shorts are stretchy, they're durable, and they are super comfy, whether I'm struggling at the gym or a full day out at the crag. And then I'm also loving their chalk bucket. When I'm bouldering, it's got this magnetic closure, which is so cool and satisfying to use. It doesn't spill, and they're just using premium materials in all that they're doing over there. Lastly, their MagDust chalk won't break the bank, and you can pick up a bundle that'll keep your hands dry and pulling hard for a whole year. It's been treating me really well out of my project. I can't say enough about it. It's a great company. And check this out. You can now score 15% off everything over at Rungne. Bags, buckets, apparel, chalk, all of that. And support the struggle while you're doing it. Just hit that link in your notes or pop by thestruggleclimbingshow.com/Rungne, R-U-N-G-N-E, and you will get that discount. All right, Garfield, we'll shift over to you. Tell Tom about yourself and your climbing.
Hey, my name's Garfield. I've been climbing about 5 years and I'm 21 years old. So I started in high school. Yeah, I guess my specific question is, I've been doing kind of mostly bouldering my entire climbing career, but recently I've been really psyched on trying to push my sport grade. But the issue I'm running into is I don't have a lot of endurance. I've got this decent strength base built up for bouldering. For reference, I probably climb like V7, V8 max, but the hardest sport I've ever sent is like 512 ARB. So I think there's a disconnect between what I can send with sport, just strength-wise, and what my endurance is holding me back to. So I guess any general tips just about training endurance once you've already got like a satisfactory strength base built up?
Yeah, sure. Well, nice to meet you, Garfield.
Nice to meet you too.
Nice to see another converter from the world of bouldering over to the dark side of rope climbing. Okay, so endurance climbing and... Right. So first thing I want to say is your perspective that you have in being a V6, V7 boulderer and in air quotes, only climbing 512 A or B on sport, I don't actually think is that unreasonable if you don't have a high degree of endurance. Because if you choose a really short bouldery, 12 A or 12 B, the cruxes are actually going to be quite hard. So there may be a little bit more or a little bit less disconnect than you might imagine right now. So I think in some ways you can actually go easy on yourself and go, you know what? My sport grade, given the level of endurance I have right now, is okay. And I am doing my best. And you are in some ways doing well and excelling and getting up those routes. And that could be something to kind of be aware of. So I would say, definitely keep trying things in that grade zone and maybe choose things initially before you do that long-term development in your endurance, which are shorter and more bouldery, so you can at least pick up experience and improve your strategy with sport climbing in a zone which physiologically does match up with what you have to bring to the table right now. So there's a big part of the equation there that you can make big improvements on and it'll last forever. Experience never goes. The development strategy never goes. You've got it then forever. And it takes many, many years to get really good at.
Okay.
Then with regards to endurance, I would try and always see endurance as being something that which kind of has three zones as such that you're working on. And the arguments for why you would do one over the other and how much you do over another does get quite complex. And that's the sort of thing which maybe isn't the best in this circumstance, because I'd have to know a reasonable amount about ordering and strategy and what you're trying to approach in the year and where you are at right now. But I can certainly say to you that when you look at your endurance, you want to, across your year, try and tackle each of these three zones as such at some point and do a decent block of training. And when I say a decent block of training, call that anywhere between 8 to 12 weeks at tackling this zone. And the good thing for you right now is, in some ways, the ordering that you do it or the way that you strategize it in the first couple of years of doing endurance training won't actually matter that much because your level right now is relatively low. So kind of whatever you do, as long as you do the work and you do those three zones, you will see really good improvements and you'll be in a great place in 2 years' time. And we are talking multiple years here. You're not going to suddenly become really endurancey in 4 months of really, really intelligent training. You'll make improvements, but you're not going to be an endurance god. So let's just bear that in mind. It takes many, many years.
Yeah.
So your zones are, is right at the bottom, you're talking about very, very low intensity, but very high volume or high duration climbing. And this is the one which people typically term as like arc training or capillarization or continuity style training. And what you're looking for here is to do continuous climbing, which is going to take you anywhere from 20 minutes to an hour in the whole session. So it's like a lot of time on rock, and you're moving at a pace or intensity where you could quite happily just chat away to people around you, and you're not thinking, oh, I'm just shake out loads and I'm going to be really tired tomorrow. It's just kind of like light plodding as such. So this is kind of like when you, if you're a runner, it's just going out and just pounding out the miles, 10, 20, 30, 100 miles a week in this really, really low intensity zone. And the reason for doing this is that you have to do it low to see the benefits on this capillarization. So that's like that blood supply network to the forearm muscles. And you get the best improvements in that through high volume and low intensity. That's the bit that's the kind of like the key factor in it. If you don't do low intensity and high volume, you won't get such big improvements in it.
Okay. You said 20 minutes to 1 hour of on the wall time.
Yeah. And you can split that a little bit.
Hopefully I'll have a train in the background.
I thought that was like maybe like the send train was rolling in. We're just like,
I wish it is. It's all hours of the day. You know, 1 a.m. They don't care. They'll blow the horn. Anyway, so 20 minutes to 1 hour of on the wall time, just really low intensity, just trying to get a volume base.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And you can break it up into little sections if you want to. You want to go and have a drink, chat to some friends. It doesn't really matter. It's just as long as the duration across the whole session is somewhere between 20 minutes to an hour.
Okay.
So it's just plodding, and it's quite a lot of it.
How many sessions per week of that, Tom?
It depends on how well trained you are as a climber. I would say 2 is your kind of like minimum effective dose across a week, but a really well-trained climber, you know, of international standard, do 5-6 sessions that week. So it depends. Yeah. Depends on how.
Yeah. If I could just as one potential for those of us who are busy, although I'd like to get your perspective, but I had a conversation with Ollie Tor about carking, as he called it, which was yeah. Parking in the car, right? So I'm sure, you know, you talked to him about that. But essentially, I rigged up a bungee cord with like a little pinch block in my car. And so when I'm driving the kids to school or I'm commuting, you know, for work, I'm putting on like a low level pump just kind of by squeezing that thing, or you could get like a foam ball or something like that. So the donuts that Lattice has, obviously it's better to move over rock because you're getting some skill, even at a low level. If you're arcing, you're still moving your hips and your body and that kind of thing. But is this mostly a physiological adaptation that you're looking for, and how effective is a foam ball for 30 minutes, you know, of low intensity when you're driving the kids to school? And how does that compare to, you know, actual climbing for 30 minutes at a low intensity?
Yeah, so physiologically, you will see improvements in the forearm endurance stamina by doing any form of exercise which involves muscle contraction in the forearm muscles. But the transfer into climbing is always going to be better the more specific the exercise is. You just got to understand it's like this playoff. If you do it on the wall, it's going to be superb transfer into climbing. If you do it with a squidgy ball, then it's going to be one of the worst forms of transfer. If it's on a little edge that you're carking whilst you're driving, probably not recommended by the police, but whatever you're doing, then it's going to be slightly better because it's like holding an actual edge and it's a 20 mil edge and you're sort of like flexing it. So it's a payoff in it. But certainly if you gave me the option of what would you like to spend 4 hours a week doing, I'd be like, I'm on the wall for sure. I'm not doing it with, yeah, like a tennis ball and squishing the tennis ball. If I've got 4 hours spare, I'm doing it on the wall because it's the best use of my time.
Yeah, fair enough. I appreciate that. Okay, we've got 2 more zones to focus on here, so I'll stop interjecting.
That's all right. So the second zone is the one that you can kind of consider as being sort of a threshold zone. So this is the type of climbing that's the intensity where you can climb somewhere between 10 to 20 minutes fairly continuously. You can, the nuance is you can break it up into little blocks of like maybe really short rests of 10, 15 seconds, but around 10 to 20 minutes of continuous climbing. And it's like, oh my goodness, I'm just shaking my way around this thing. pretty pumped, but you'll get through that 10 to 20 minutes. So it's like that, I'm just about in control. You're not power screaming through it. You're not failing, but you're also not just chilling and chatting with friends. You're really concentrating and you're having to control that pump. So that's your threshold zone. And that's, again, another really important zone to work on. And then
and that could be once a week for those who are not very well trained on this, and multiple times a week for those who are.
Yeah. Again, I would say two times a week is really your minimum effective dose. You might get away with once a week if you've never done any form of endurance training. But I would say within a few weeks, you'll start to just not see a return from it. It will have to likely be amped up to twice a week. Just once a week of anything is hard to see as some sort of physiological stimulus without just like a detraining effect occurring each time.
So just to make sure I've got you straight on that one, that training day looks like just the 10 to 20 minutes at that sort of grade in which you can climb continuously.
Yeah. So that'd be your endurance sections. You'd never do your zone 1, 2, and 3 all in the same day. Mm-hmm. You would just choose for that part of the season, I'm just going to mainly do zone one stuff. Of course, the nuance of it is that often people will do a blend of zone 1 and 3, for example, or they'll do 2s and 3s or whatever it is. But in a very simplistic sense, if you want to improve endurance, just focus on one. You'll be fine, but just get on with the work, be really consistent with it, do your 8 to 12 week blocks, and you'll see improvements. It just gets more, you have to be more intelligent about your approach the more you get into that bit of like, oh yeah, I have pretty good endurance these days. And I'm now starting to refine this quite a bit. The last zone is your sort of zone 3 stuff, which is more in what I class as maybe interval style training. So this is climbing at an intensity where it's unlikely for you to be able to climb continuously for much more than about, say, 2 to 3 minutes without feeling really flipping pumped or even failing. And then you will do that intensity of climbing in blocks of anywhere between 1 to 2 minutes long. And then you will do those 1 to 2 minute blocks with rests, which more or less match up with the amount of time that you are climbing. So if you're climbing for 1 minute on, you take 1 minute off. 1 minute on, 1 minute off. You could do 2 minutes on, 2 minutes off. You could also do 2 minutes on, 1 minute off. It's just sort of roughly speaking that kind of ratio. Just think of it as lots of little blocks of interval style. But the important thing is the intensity is high enough where you would not be thinking, oh, I could do this for 10 minutes continuously or 20 minutes. It's got to be a little bit too hard for what would normally be endurance training. And you're looking for a sort of intermediate level climber of doing around 10 minutes of total training time in that. So that might be 10 1-minute blocks. Or 5 2-minute blocks. But elite level climbers might aim up more towards, say, 20 minutes of total time.
Okay. And about how many times a week? Just rough guideline for that one.
Again, 2 times a week, I'd say, is a good starting point. Yeah.
Cool. All
right. Yeah. And thanks for being so thorough on that, Tom. So just so I'm also recalling, you're looking at these as blocks in the simplest terms, saying maybe 8 to 12 weeks where we would focus heavily on zone 1. So just that arcing conversational, you know, 20 minutes, a few times a week. We could do some climbing in there, you know, have a fun gym session where we're trying hard and that kind of thing. But in terms of like our endurance focus, we're going to be focusing on that. Then after that 8-week block, we would go into that zone 2 for 8 weeks and be very focused on that and maybe not do any arcing whatsoever. We could do some climbing, but maybe the endurance focus is now fully shifted to that next zone. Am I understanding that?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, exactly. And this is a really broad, rough approach to take because obviously anything that I'll do in terms of planning and strategizing people's training is very much with the ball of like, I want to know what your history is. I want to know what your goals are, how many times a week you have spare, what you're doing with all your other sessions of strength endurance, complementary strength and conditioning work. So this is very much like a rough broad stroke approach, but it will work in so many cases when you have anyone that says my endurance is poor, I've come from a bouldering background, I'm trying to convert across into route climbing, and you'll see really good returns from doing this kind of approach. And just remember with all of this is you will know if this is working, because you will notice about 4 weeks or so into your whatever exercise you're choosing, they'll just start to feel easier and you'll be able to complete them on one grade harder, or you'll be able to do slightly more sets of exactly the same exercises. And that's your indicator when the thing is working well. If you're getting to 4 weeks and you're getting worse, 9 times out of 10, you just need to take some rest. You just pushed it too hard. You've done too much other climbing on top of it. And just take a week of lighter exercise and you'll probably see a good result.
I appreciate all the insight. And also just about how long I can expect this process to take, so I can keep my expectations for myself in check.
Yeah, it takes a good amount of time. Like a little anecdote that I give to people sometimes is when I first started Lattice, Ollie Tor, who I started Lattice with, he was one of the very first people that I assessed when I was doing all these kind of strength assessments with climbers. And he had some of the strongest fingers that I'd ever measured in all of my, you know, career of working with GB athletes and testing some pretty strong people. But he had the most hideous levels of stamina with it. So he had the strongest fingers pretty much I'd ever measured, but the ability to not even get up a 513A, 13B. I might be doing him a disservice here. Maybe he could do one across a whole trip if he projected it, but something like that, but with outrageously strong fingers. I would say it took him somewhere, what year would that have been? That might have been something like 2013. And it was maybe 2021 that I would say I finally looked at Ollie and went, this guy's got pretty good fitness. He's really quite an evolved climber. So it was like 8 years that he took him to get to that point. And he worked really hard at it, and he knows how to train. So it's not a quick fix. If you're really, really poor in endurance and really quite strong, you've got to take a long-term approach to this. It takes time.
Ryan, I do have one more question if we have time. I realize that one sort of took a while, but...
Yeah, sure. Well, let me loop back to it in just a second. I think we will have a few minutes. There's one climber that was intending to be in this conversation, and they got a really bad migraine, weren't able to join, but I have their question here. And so I want to make sure that they get represented in this, and then we'll open it back up for some follow-up questions, Tom's time permitting here. And so this is from Ben, who's 27. And Ben says, I'm 6'7", and I struggle immensely with small box problems and can't seem to overcome them. Ben goes on to say, I'm also not the best with slopers and I slip off quite easily. I'm a relatively new climber, about a year and a half of consistency. And I have climbing experience from childhood, but recently started bouldering seriously. I love it, but I'm getting angry at my body. So 6'7", I don't know how many of that stones or what system you use over there, Queen's hands or something like that, whatever, however tall, it's just really tall, I feel like, Tom, comparative to maybe the average climber. So what do you say for Ben there?
Rude. That's so... Ryan Devlin, don't you know that we both use the same flipping measurements for height? We use feet in inches as well.
What? No, you don't.
Yeah, we do.
What? No.
Yes.
Is this real?
Yes,
come on. No, don't use it. You're like, it's centimeters, right? Isn't everything centimeters?
No, that's the French. We leave them with their cheese and baguettes.
How am I just learning this at 44 years old? You use feet in inches?
Yes.
That's like, but then you use meters. No? For route length?
Yeah, when we have to talk to Europeans, we'll talk our meters, but we measure everything in miles, and everyone, like, I'm 5'10.5", and I only learned my height in centimeters when I started doing, like, assessments for Lattice, and I actually had to look up what I was in centimeters.
But that's what I'm saying, because I've been with Lattice for years now, and every time I have to enter my things, I have to freaking convert them to kilograms, and I have to convert them to centimeters, and I'm like, damn it, Tom, but it's not you, it's... some French programmer? What, like, I guess it's just the rest of the world uses metric system?
Yeah, behind the lattice surface is just a team of French programmers, didn't you know?
Eating baguettes?
I hope we haven't insulted too many French people here.
You'll piss off Tom Randall and Ryan Devlin with his metric system. I mean, obviously, this imperial system that we're on is absolute rubbish, to borrow one of my favorite words from your side of the pond there. But like, I cannot believe I'm this many years old and I'm just discovering that you guys use the imperial system. But wait, do you use pounds? Not British pounds, but like pounds of weight. You use kilograms?
Rather confusingly, we kind of do, except we tend to, although the new Gen Z lot now, I think, do actually use kilograms in weight, but I grew up using stone. So I would weigh like 11 stone. I think I weigh about 11 stone. But nowadays I use kilograms. So yeah, stone is like the larger weight over pounds.
God, this is going to be this is a separate podcast we're going down right now, but I'm really fascinated by this. Okay, I'm going to stop wasting everybody's time on this. Did you guys know this though? Did you all know that the British were using inches? This does not make sense to me.
Johnny is the European, definitely, as I can see him shaking his head.
Johnny knows what he's talking about. Luxembourgians know. But like, because I feel like Canada uses centimeters. We need a Canadian to chime in on this. Whoa. Okay. Anyway, I'm like flustered now. This is so weird. Where were we? Okay, Ben, 6'7". So you can relate. Now you understand 6'7", and we're all on the same page here now. What do you say to Ben, the small box problems being 6'7"?
Yeah. Well, firstly, that is a tall climber, and we definitely don't come across many climbers in that 6'7" category. I think that is over 2 meters off the top of my head. So it's pretty tall.
And you often hear the other side, right? The shorter climber is saying, oh, I can't reach it. If I only had more reach or more of an ape. And so Ben brings kind of a different perspective, which is like, you know, they're having problems being so tall on certain problems. Obviously, it could be an advantage on certain problems as well.
Yeah. So one thing to recognize is you're not changing your body. You've been dealt what you've been dealt with in life. So you're going to have to work with the tools that you have. So I think there's some work there to be done in terms of recognizing that there is an approach to get angry about it, but there's also one that's probably going to be more productive where you can get into a mindset where you're not angry. So I rarely see anyone perform well when they're angry. It's just not really a thing in climbing. So I think that's important to kind of understand. And I would say there's two kind of get outs or solutions as such to this particular problem. Is you have outdoor climbing, I think, is a great place for the tall climber to spend more of their time, because there are so many options for hands and feet outdoors. They're not set by a setter who is your classic, I don't know, 5'10, 5'11 male root setter, who probably is like the dominant force in the indoor root setting industry globally. So you will have options and you'll be better rewarded for it. So you'll quite often be told by your friends, oh, I can't believe you lanked between those holes, or you can use that foothold over there. And you'll be going, oh, great, I love outdoors because I'm really tall and I can use all of the things here. So I think that's a really good option to explore. You get into a more positive mindset. And I think Ben may find that he'll start to even be grateful of his height if he goes outdoors more and realizes the advantage that it buys him in quite a few different situations. So I think that could be a really good thing to do. And then secondly is to try and do something which is a little bit similar to what I said at the beginning of the session, is find people who are kind of like your clan, your types of people, and find other people either on the internet or in the gym that are taller as well, and say, oh, can I session this problem with you? Oh, how do you deal with it where you've got those really tucked up toe hooks where you know that the setter had a straight leg on that toe hook and that toe hook felt totally durable, but right now we feel like we've got our knee up by our belly button, so actually this is just a desperate move for us. And the person will say, oh yeah, no, don't worry, I've been climbing for 20 years and I'm a tall climber. And actually what you do is you swap it to a heel in this situation. Just don't copy everyone else's beta. And I think that's the two things I would do. Get outside and then deliberately choose tall climbers to go and session with and learn from them.
Awesome advice. Tall Climbers Anonymous group is going to be blowing up where Ben climbs there. Thanks, Tom. Fantastic stuff. So yeah, everybody was able to get a bit of a coaching session here with Tom, and we do have a few minutes left. Maybe we could do a little bit of a rapid fire thing here, nothing too in depth, but maybe some quick answer or some yes, no type questions for Tom. Garfield, I know you had a follow up, and then for the rest of you all on here, if you've got something you can just like raise your hand and I'll school style, I'll call on you here, but Gaur, go ahead.
Yeah, I'll try and keep this question as brief as possible, but I'm going to be in Alaska for a bit this summer, about a month, and I'm not going to have any access to climbing, gym, whatever, but I will have a portable hangboard. So my question is, what can I do with just a hangboard and maybe a pull-up bar to train and or maintain endurance?
Okay, yeah. So portable hangboard or fixed hangboard is a really good tool that is still pretty effective for endurance training. What you want to do is you want to get yourself a setup where you can have some kind of assistance on the portable board in the form of either a pulley or a pulley and rope setup or an elastic resistance band that you can put your foot in. So you want to get yourself set up with some sort of assistance system. And then the other thing that you want to set yourself up with is a position where you can have a block, a stool, a chair that's set in a position where your body effectively looks like it's on a 45 degree overhang. So your body's at like that angle and your hands are up here hanging the bar and your feet are here on a stool. And it almost mimics like you're in the position of being on overhanging terrain.
Mm-hmm.
And then all you're doing in these positions of either standard hangs at body weight or with assistance with a pulley or a resistance band or with the stool is you're mimicking climbing movement where you're moving around on your portable board and trying to kind of replicate and produce moves in an ideal sense. That's the perfect way. If your fingerboard, portable fingerboard doesn't work in that way and it rocks around too much, you can't actually stabilize enough to do it, then it's about, I would say, choosing things which are either static positions. So just holding a position, coming off, readjusting and going to like a different position on the fingerboard, or you're doing Frenchies and you're doing those kind of half locks. So 90 degree lock, 120, full straight arm, back up 90, 20, et cetera, and doing combinations of exercises like that. And really what you do is you just pay attention to those same rules that I gave you previously with the zones that you train into. And I would suggest that if you're going to be doing that on a portable board and it is only 4 weeks, just pick one of the zones which is more practical to train. So I'd probably look at the interval style stuff because it'll be really tedious to do an hour on a fingerboard with a stool. You can do it, but it takes a certain, I don't know, certain something.
Great. Thank you.
Definitely can build some endurance on a hangboard. Good luck in Alaska, man. It's great climbing up there too. So go on an adventure if you can. Other questions? I'll open it up to the group here. Any follow-ups based on some of the really sound answers that Tom gave to the rest of the team's questions?
Yeah, I actually have a question about a project I have. It's a boulder, a pretty long boulder. I can do every move but one. It's, for me, I didn't find any other beta. It's a forced barn door. It's 60 degrees overhanging. I have my left hand and my left feet go from a little crimp to a good hold and your barn door around your left side. Do you have any tips to train that specifically? And please don't say body tension because I hate that.
Yeah, so I would not actually say there would be a training tip for this. I would say it would be more like a practice movement trick, which is two things I would go for on this. Is one is I would ask the whoever you go climbing with is on your barn door move that you're sort of like moving to and you're maybe failing to either catch the hold or when you're catching it, you're just swinging off too far, is ask the people that you're with to give you some form of power spot where they just take out like 1 to 5 kilos of force on the barn door so that you can at least feel what it's like to actually catch the movement and hold it and then pull back in and the foot swings back in and you're like, oh, right, now I'm going to continue. And what you'll find is by giving just a tiny bit of assistance to a move and then repeatedly doing that in a session like 5 to 10 times with just a tiny bit of assistance, you actually up your skill. And you might find that just by having the assistance and actually latching it a few times, you then go, you know what, I'll have a go at this just on my own. And suddenly you're doing it and you're going, holy smokes, this wasn't even something I had to train. I just hadn't had a chance to catch it and feel what my body does when it does the complete movement from start to finish. I just needed a bit of assistance to do it. So I think that can be a really useful kind of tool in this situation. And then the other thing with like this style of, sort of barn door move or anything like that, is not necessarily taking a body tension approach to it, is taking a speed approach and trying the move at a different speed. So either going much slower or much faster in the move. And it's not necessarily that the act of going faster or slower will solve it and you'll be like, oh, no, I'm suddenly holding the barn door because I went much faster. It's more like you get the mind to just work in a different way. So you try it really fast now for two or three goes and then go, right, I'm going to go back to what the speed feels right to me. And you've, again, almost like tricked yourself to upping the skill level. And you'll come back to it and go, oh, no, slower. I can totally hold this barn door because I just tried it really fast and I nearly did it that way. And now if I do it slowly, I can. So that would be the other thing I'd approach to that.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, it's funny that you mentioned the power sporting, because on my last go, I even tried to find a spot where I can make some attachment with a rubber band to put away some weight, because I was solo there. I actually tried that and I had nothing there really to build it up. But maybe, yeah, that would be a good approach. Yeah, I actually thought about it myself, but I did not follow it to the end. So that's
good. Power spotting is amazing. It's such a good way of doing things at your limit.
Perfect. Thank you.
I had a conversation with Allison Vest, the pro clinic on advanced bouldering tactics. And one of her top tips was to really embrace the power spot, to get into those positions and feel them and then reduce it. And then, you know, you don't need it anymore. Really cool, Tom. Very much grateful for your time here. We're just about at time. Did anybody else have a last minute quickie? Tom, do you have any questions for us? Can we give you any sort of coaching advice here? You know, would you like some totally unqualified coaching advice from those of us on this call?
Yeah, Ryan, how are you going to get me over to Red River Gorge so I actually turn up?
Tom, I mean, now that I know that we're even speaking the same language with regard to inches, we're just inches from having you over here to the Red this fall. You know, my coach, Roz, is coming over this fall, and she's going to be here for, like, I don't know, 4 weeks or something like that. She's going to send everything in the Red. She's so strong. So come on over here, like, hop a ride with her. She'll cover the cost of your bags. And
do you think I should come over with Roz?
I really think you do. You know, she's staying in my cabin, and there are going to be extra beds. You can stay. Come on over with Roz. Stay in the cabin. We'll film. Derek will show you around Death by Chocolate. He'll have sent by then, which is great. You can hop on my project. I will not have sent by then. So you can come and, you know, project with me.
Maybe this is all it needed, was just a public affirmation that I was going to come to Red River Gorge on your podcast.
Yes.
And then you'll tell Roz, and Roz will give me shit in the office the whole time about why haven't I sorted out my trip. And
you heard it here first. You heard it here first, everyone. Tom is coming to the Red this fall. Come on out and watch him.
You know.
Yes. Please do it. You know, we've got some others.
What month is she coming?
November. It's the best month in the Red.
I might come this year, you know.
I'm so hyped.
The reason why we did this.
Yes, we're going to drink brown cows and send the Red. Oh, this is exciting.
No one drink brown cows, please. They're bad for you.
I saw Katie put it in the group chat. They also have caffeine. Are you off the brown cows, or can you can do a Coke?
No, I love a brown cow, really. It's just not very good for you, I don't think.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what is good for us? Yeah. Oh, I'm really hyped on this, Tom. Well, good. We'll coordinate. We'll plan for our big fall season together now. And hey, thank you so much. This was, look, I was going to give it a coin toss on whether this call-in episode was going to crash and burn or not, but I think we landed it. And really appreciate Derek, Johnny, Katie, Garfield, as well as Ben, who wasn't on. Thank you for your thoughtful questions and for taking part. And Tom, for just bringing your expertise, as always, to the struggle here, man. We're really grateful for you.
Yeah, I think that works really well. It's really nice to see everyone's faces on screen. And I was saying to people in the office today, Lass is like, I've got this group call-in thing. It's like a radio show back in the 1990s. I have no idea how this is going to go, but I feel like it's going to be good fun. And I've loved it. It's been really good. I'll do this any other time, literally any other time you want.
And that'll wrap things up here with our buddy Coach Tom Randall in what is certain to be the first of many of these kind of call-in style episodes. I just had so much fun doing this. I hope you guys enjoyed it. And huge shout out and thank you to the climbers who joined this call. Hope you all got a lot out of that session with Tom.
Now, if you would like to hear more of these and have a shot at chatting with Tom directly yourself, please share this episode on Instagram and then tag me on it, and I will reach out to you to be part of the next crop of athletes that we will line up to have a session here with Tom. We had a lot of fun. I think you're going to enjoy it. Thank you for sharing if you can. Also, holy smokes, I just got to say, my mind is still blown about this whole UK system of measurement being the same here in America. Did you guys know about this? Am I like, was there like a gap in my education? Did my parents fail me? I mean, probably, but like, I mean, I just had no idea. I mean, it's a little bit of a mutt system because they're using like stone, but they're also using miles. I don't know. I just thought everybody else was on metric because, you know, the US is insane when it comes to its measuring system. But Tom is insane too, and I like that. Let me know. I don't know why I'm still rambling about this. I truly, like, it just threw me off. If you knew about this and you didn't tell me, I blame you. You're part of the problem. So let me know if this was news to you or not. And if it was news to you, at least I'll feel a little bit better about that. Maybe this is like a whole like conspiracy that the Queen was keeping for all these years, and we're just now like discovering it. I don't know. Anyway, apart from that, I do want to say something else here as we're wrapping up. I'm releasing a bonus episode to patrons and Apple subscribers that sprang out of this conversation here with Tom, where he shares a really cool and unique perspective on why it might seem like V17 boulder problems are going down fast and furious lately, and what that means for top-end bouldering and the potential for a V18 to be around the corner. That part of our conversation didn't quite fit into this live call-in format, so I've packaged it as a bonus episode that you can get for like $5 a month over on Patreon or Apple subscriptions, or free with a 7-day trial. In fact, I'll hit some music here. Or free with a 7-day trial. I'll tell you more about that right now. Hey, if you'd like to see the uncut video of this chat and score instant access to more than 40 hours of bonus content, including bonus episodes with the likes of Adam Andra, Hazel Finlay, Alex Honnold, Chris Sharma, Allison Vest, Tom Randall, and so many more amazing athletes and coaches, you can get it all for about the price of a beer each month. And I'm telling you, I could really go for a beer right now. So if you are in a position to buy me one, that would be so rad. There's also a free trial happening right now. So you know, if you want to date me a little bit before you buy me that beer, I get it. And I'm just really grateful for your support as I grind away down here in my basement podcast / utility closet. You can swing on over to patreon.com/thestruggleclimbingshow to access that full library of bonus content. Or if you're an iPhone person, you can subscribe right there in your Apple podcast player. Huge thanks and appreciation to our show sponsors who have brought you this episode at zero cost. Check your show notes for those links and special discounts that are only available to you, the Struggle listener. And by the way, you can see all of the show's partners and special deals by popping over to thestruggleclimbingshow.com/deals. Did you know that The Struggle is carbon neutral in partnership with the Honnold Foundation? Well, you do now. They are doing such amazing work, you guys, to bring clean energy to communities around the world. You can get all inspired by their latest grant recipients over at honnoldfoundation.org. And toss them some love if you can. They are doing such impactful, amazing work. And lastly, The Struggle is a proud member of the Plugtone Audio Collective, a diverse group of the best, most impactful podcasts in the outdoor industry. This show was produced and hosted by me, Ryan Devlin. All right, that clips the anchors on this episode. Thank you so, so much for tuning in. And if you liked it, and if this show in general just brings you some value and some joy, would you consider sharing it with your buddies, with your climb friends, your relationships, your gym crew, whatever, you know what I'm talking about. Just share it. The more who listen, the closer I will get to making this my full-time gig, which would just be so rad. Thank you. I love you. All right, I hope your training and climbing are going great, and I will see you next week.